Welcome to today's presentation, the 2017 Legislative Update for Law Enforcement. This webinar is brought to you by the Utah Prosecution Council, the Statewide Association of Prosecutors, and Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training. I'm Christopher Fielding of Post Media Services, and I will be moderating today's webinar. We are also pleased to have with us today Bob Church, Director, Utah Prosecution Council, and Tyson Skeen, Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor with the Utah Prosecution Council. We'll now turn the time over to Director Church.
Actually, I think Tyson was going to introduce us, but it's our pleasure to be here, everybody.
Yeah, we just wanted to take a few seconds here to talk about the legislative update this year. This was actually a session that saw a record number of bills in our legislature. We seem to say that every year going forward. Now it just seems to increase year by year. What that means for our purposes today is we're going to be very quick as we go through these bills. We're not going to touch every single thing and not go into great detail on all of them. Some of them we'll spend a little bit more time on. But if you have questions, don't be afraid to reach out to us at UPC. We're happy to help wherever we can. You also have your city and county attorneys that can help answer questions on these things as well. So with that, we'll just get going into the legislative update and go through this one by one.
Okay. For those of you that are following along with the House bills, or excuse me, our PDF file, is we'll go ahead and we'll give you the name of the bill as well as the page number. So I'm starting off with House Bill 17 on page 2. This is offenses against the person amendments. What this is primarily dealing with is strangulation. We have some new and better language that has been added to the strangulation bill. And so there are some things that you're all going to need to prove in order to show strangulation as an aggravated assault. And so what that is any act that impedes the breathing or circulation of blood of another person by the actor's use of unlawful force or violence that is used, that is likely to produce loss of consciousness. And how we produce loss of consciousness is two ways, applying pressure to the neck or the throat of a person or by obstructing the nose, mouth, or airway of the person. And then how we as prosecutors are going to have to prove loss or the force is likely to produce loss of consciousness is either through the witness testifying that they lost consciousness or, and I'm not sure how they came up with this definition, but if the pressure applied was equal to an ordinary handshake for 10 seconds. So as you're interviewing the victims, you know, talk to them about whether or not they in fact lost consciousness, how they know they lost it, or, you know, have them describe the amount of pressure that was used. Now, strangulation has always been a third-degree felony, but if unconsciousness is a result of the strangulation, then that bumps it up to a second-degree felony. Now, this bill also adds similar language to the definition of the child abuse statute in 76-5109. Now added as a serious physical injury to a child is language, two new sections. One, any impediment to the breathing, circulation of the blood applied by pressure to the neck, throat, or chest, or obstruction to the mouth, it's likely to produce a loss of consciousness. Or the second new element is unconsciousness caused by the unlawful infliction of a brain injury or unlawfully causing any deprivation of oxygen to the brain. So just be aware that there's a similar language that has been added to the child abuse statute.
House Bill 48, Wildlife Species Introduction Amendments. This is on page 6 of the PDF. This is a bill that's just trying to target those that are illegally transporting or introducing species into the wild. We see these invasive species all over the state. A lot of times we see this with fishing, people putting fish. There's a big problem with that with northern pike in Utah Lake right now, which causes a problem because of the June sucker. And so it's just beefing up that statute, making a Class A misdemeanor or a third-degree felony, depending on the species and if that species had been known to exist in that part of the state before. So this is going to apply mostly to our wildlife officers who are handling these things, but realize they've beefed up this statute and added some provisions that make it a higher penalty for people who are transplanting and transporting wildlife in the state without legal authority to do so.
Okay, at the bottom of page 6, House Bill 51, this is dealing with off-highway vehicle amendments, is a child under the age of 8 can now operate a broad range of off-highway vehicles as long as it's at an organized practice or a sanctioned race, as long as they're under the direct supervision of an adult. So there's just some changes in the language of the statute there, so be aware of that.
House Bill 56, accessible parking amendments, handicap accessible parking amendments on page 9. There's several new placards that have been created under this from wheelchair users and people with temporary walking disabilities and such. We don't really need to spend a lot of time on that. The big change for those who are maybe doing handicap parking enforcement will realize that it used to the law used to require that the handicap placard was hanging from the rearview mirror. Now the requirement is simply that it needs to be displayed in a manner that it is visible from the front of the vehicle. So if it's on the dash, even if it's on a seat, if it can be seen from the front of the vehicle, that is now legal under the statute. And just be aware that you may be seeing some different placards. They're not counterfeit or fraud. They just created some new things. You might see a little bit of difference there as well.
Let's see. Were you going to do House Bill 99?
I can take that one.
Yeah, just briefly.
House Bill 99, bigamy offenses. This was a big one that got a lot of attention during the session. This was a bill that the AG's office was very involved in and working on and getting the proper language. You'll recall that we have had some issues with the constitutionality of our old bigamy statute. This is bringing it in line with what will be likely held constitutional, the AG's office feels. It used to be that if somebody purported to be married or cohabitated with them, that was good enough. But now it is they're purporting to be married and cohabitating. So that does make a little bit of a change. It does offer some other changes, some safe havens for people involved in bigamy when they report as well. That's one of the concerns, is that people who are victims of other crimes but are involved in polygamous or bigamous marriages, they feel like they'll come in and report these crimes and then be charged with bigamy. Kind of have a chilling effect. There are some safeguards built in for people reporting other things in regards to that too. If you do have questions on this, feel free to reach out to the AG's office. They are very involved in this. It's probably not something we're going to see a whole lot of because I think that the policies around the state are generally that they need to be involved with other crimes. It's not going to be something that's just going to happen, but there was a small change there as well.
Okay, over on page 13, House Bill 110, Controlled Substance Abuse Amendments. Most of you heard last year that there were the two teenagers in Park City that died from using the synthetic drug Pink. It's a form of fentanyl. We know that fentanyl's incredibly dangerous. Tyson brought to my attention and was sharing with officers across the state, the officer in Ohio. Do you want to tell him about that?
Yeah, and you probably all heard about this, but we had that officer in Ohio a couple months ago who had done a vehicle search, and they found substances that they thought were fentanyl, so they followed protocol, gloved up, did everything they were supposed to do. Later in the shift, several hours in the shift, he's back at the station, and one of the fellow officers noticed that he had a powder on his uniform and just said, "Hey, you got something on your uniform." The officer simply brushed the powder off with his hand, and within an hour had overdosed. And the reports that I read said that they had to hit him with 4 shots of Narcan to save his life. This is extremely, extremely dangerous stuff. We have it here, right here in our state. I know a lot of times we think, oh, that's not a Utah problem. We just had one of the largest fentanyl busts in the country in Salt Lake County this summer or earlier later in the spring. It's here. It's definitely here, and it may not be a problem like it is in the Midwest and the Northeast yet, but it's here. So just be prepared for it. I always use the example of, it always used to be that, you know, you find a bag of marijuana in a car, and the first thing you do is you pop it open, you smell it, because anybody who's been a police officer for more than about 3 or 4 seconds can tell you what marijuana smells like. Don't do that stuff anymore. It's just, you have no idea what was in that bag, either with the marijuana or before the marijuana. And we don't want one of our officers to be the next national news story on this fentanyl stuff. It is dangerous. Please take it seriously. I've been imploring admin in all departments to make sure your officers have protective gear, make sure they have Narcan. I know those are controversial subjects, but it's something that our officers need for their safety to be able to do their job. So that's my soapbox on that subject.
Right. And because they're lacing marijuana with fentanyl, I mean,
yep.
Yeah, it's just incredibly dangerous. Just this morning, I heard a PSA about Narcan, and up in Davis County, hospitals are providing that to family members, anybody that they think will OD. So just be incredibly careful. So what they've done with this bill is they've added three new forms of fentanyl to the controlled substance statute, as well as three new formulas for spice. You know, spice is never going to go away, and so we're just trying to play catch-up with the addition of those formulas to the bill.
House Bill 123, Juvenile Offenses Amendments, on page 15. This is a bill that, as I understand it, it came about because there was a misrepresentation to the legislature. They were misled on what the current law actually was. They thought or were told that juveniles engaging in sexual offenses essentially could be charged with a first-degree felony and carry the penalties and continuing penalties of sex offender registries and things like that for the rest of their life, or they could be charged with nothing, which everybody who knows anything about the law knows that that's not true. So that's where this bill actually came from, is a misrepresentation and a misunderstanding, which is unfortunate. But it created a new law, or a new definition, essentially, of unlawful adolescent sexual activity. The problem with this is we still kind of don't even know how this applies, because it basically says it does not apply to, and it goes off and lists all the things that are already against the law. So unlawful adolescent sexual activity does not apply to, and it gives a big long list, and it's all those things that are already against the law. And so it needs to be some type of activity, sexual activity, that's not already, you know, rape, object rape, sodomy, sodomy on a child, sexual assault, sexual abuse, incest, all these things that are already prohibited under our law. It doesn't apply to any of that. So I'm not really sure what it applies to. And then it also creates kind of a complicated matrix based upon the ages of the parties and the level of offense, from a Class C misdemeanor all the way up to a third degree felony and everything in between, just basically based upon the ages of the parties. A couple maybe shortfalls with this bill, at least one major one, is it always assumes the older party is the guilty one in this case, and we know that's not true. It very well could be the 13-year-old in the relationship was very manipulative and getting a 15-year-old to engage in sexual activity. But the 15-year-old is the one who would be breaking the law in this situation, regardless of who drove the conduct. And keep in mind, this is always only with consensual sexual activity, because if it's non-consensual, you're going to go under one of these other things that's already against the law. And so it's probably not going to apply a ton. It's a convoluted definition, like I said. Use your discretion as you're doing this, because the things that are already on the books are probably the more appropriate charges anyways. This created another opportunity or a new law to be able to enforce, but it's going to be difficult to be able to do so. It's still, even after it's been in effect for some time now, we still don't really know exactly what all the provisions of it truly mean. So,
okay, there at the bottom of page 15, House Bill 124, what this does is it expands the definition of peace officer for the offense of assault on a peace officer. Excuse me. So it has expanded the definition of correctional officer, special function officer, and federal officer. Or excuse me, hasn't expanded those definitions, have just added those definitions of officers to assault on a peace officer. Okay, let's see. Over on page 17, House Bill 138, Public Safety Amendments. Speaking of special function officers, this now adds a list of people that can be prosecuted for engaging in illegal custodial sexual relations. So it now includes sworn and certified officer performing specialized investigations, process servers, constables, security officers, or those officers that enforce local ordinances. So just be aware, if you've got a prisoner in custody and you are one of these officers and engage in an inappropriate sexual relationship, you now can be charged.
Breaking news, don't have sex with people who are in custody.
Exactly.
House Bill 139, Criminal Intent Amendments, again on page 17. This is a bill that started out as, and this is more for prosecutors than it is for police officers, but it goes to defenses available for criminal intent, essentially. There's a defense that's available under Utah Code for some laws, not all laws, but there are some laws, many laws, where it applies, actually, a voluntary intoxication. So somebody could say that even though I voluntarily took this substance, alcohol, drugs, whatever it was, and became intoxicated, I was so intoxicated that I couldn't formulate the mens rea or the criminal intent needed to commit that crime. Well, this bill started out by eliminating that defense entirely, which I thought was a really good idea. But nobody asked me, and it didn't stay that way. And so it kind of swung the pendulum all the way back the other way and said, we're not going to allow voluntary intoxication just for the crime of rape, which is good, but probably didn't go far enough. And then it kind of came back a little bit. So this voluntary intoxication defense is no longer available for any of the sexual offenses in 76.5 Part 4. That's where all of our sexual offenses are listed. So any offense in that section, it is not a defense. Somebody cannot use that voluntary intoxication defense in those crimes. House Bill 155 on page 19, this is a DUI amendment. This was another one that has probably got a lot more attention since the legislative session than it did during the legislative session. Most people will know this as the law that reduced the per se BAC from a 0.08 to a 0.05 here in Utah. One thing to be aware of with this bill specifically is the effective date on everything that I'm going to talk about here isn't until December 30th, 2018. So we're still a long ways out from this bill going into effect. Although some of the anecdotal information we're hearing from UHP and a couple other departments are is that they're actually seeing less DUIs and people have lower BACs after they're doing field sobriety tests, and they've asked the question why, and they're actually reporting, well, that new bill went into effect. And so the whole purpose of this, according to Representative Thurston, who ran this bill, was just to change a culture and to get people to make less DUI trips. And it seems, at least anecdotally, very early in the process that we're actually seeing that on the ground. So, but again, the bill does not go into effect for another almost 18 months, 14 months, wherever we're at here, 16 months. Everybody's aware of what it does with the BAC, but there's another provision of this that not a lot of people have paid attention to, and that's creates two different new classes of alcohol-restricted drivers. So essentially, anybody who's getting their driver's license for the first time, regardless of what their age is, it could be somebody who's 30 years old who's finally getting a driver license, is essentially an alcohol-restricted driver for the first 2 years. It creates this novice learner driver and novice licensed driver. The other is anybody who has not had a driver license in any of the states of the United States is an alcohol-restricted driver for the first 2 years that they are here. That one's a little bit more problematic, and there are people looking at that. It's kind of under attack. They think it discriminates against minorities and others. If you've been driving in Germany for 40 years and you come to the state of Utah to live and you finally get a Utah driver license, it would make you an alcohol-restricted driver. And so they're taking a little bit closer look at that. We'll see where it is. They're taking a closer look at this entire bill. There's a lot of people who aren't happy with it. And so we'll see where it goes. One thing I'll just say very briefly on the 0.05, if this bill stays where it's at and we just have a simple reduction of the per se limit from 0.08 to 0.05, the training that you will receive as law enforcement officers is to not do anything any differently than you're doing right now or that you did a year ago or 5 years ago with a DUI investigation. You should still go through the entire investigation the exact same way you do. You should still arrest somebody because you feel like they're too impaired to drive, and then you go get a chemical test. For all intents and purposes, we don't know what somebody's BAC is until you've arrested them anyways, because that PBT result isn't admissible in trial anyways. So the only admissible chemical test that we get is your breath, blood, or urine sample that you're getting. And so don't change how you're doing things. Continue to do your investigation the exact same way, and we probably won't see a huge change in how this impacts you on the side of the road because of that. Now, if they go ahead and mess it up like they're trying to do and and create a completely convoluted and interesting compromise that they're trying to come up with, then all bets are off, because that might very well change how you do things on the side of the road. But for now, as the law stands, and until it changes, unless and until it changes, my message is don't change how you're doing a DUI investigation at all. Just because the per se BAC has dropped, we're still looking for impaired drivers. And if you do field sobriety tests and don't believe somebody's impaired, then you're not making that arrest anyway. So that's the message on House Bill 155.
Okay, I'll do House Bill 184 over on page 23. This is dealing with contraband device destruction is the title that we've given it. So what this bill allows is for law enforcement officers to seize any computer device. And what they have defined that as, you can see there in the materials, is electronic, magnetic, optical, electrochemical, other high-speed data processing, you know, that basically can store digital information. You can seize it if it's being used in cases involving child pornography, used for fraud or ID theft. And at the conclusion of the case, when the prosecutor gives you the go-ahead, then you can go ahead and destroy those items. Now, what you need to be aware of is that individuals can request personal information, legal information from, you know, those computers, banking information, tax documents, things like that. We even had the question, legal porn. So, they can get their legal porn back. They just can't have their illegal porn. But what was interesting is I was talking with one of the prosecutors for ICAC, the Internet Crimes Against Children, and, you know, smart TVs, even a smart fridge can store some of these items if they're smart enough and know how to store data on, computer chip or whatever it's in your smart fridge. So just be aware that people are getting more and more sophisticated on where they can hide this type of information.
Smart fridge?
Yeah.
Those things existed.
Oh, yeah. It's one that will tell you that you're out of milk.
Wow.
You know, or your eggs are running low or something like that. So.
All right. Well, there you go. 2017. Yeah. Welcome to the new age.
Exactly.
I'll do House Bill 198.
Okay.
On page 25, concealed carry amendments. This is the bill that reduced and added actually a provisional carry permit available to those 18 years old or older. In addition to what we have for those who are 21 and older on concealed carry permits. A couple of things to be aware of here is, first and foremost, this doesn't just change the age of a concealed carry permit. It adds a provisional carry permit, and it is only good for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. If somebody were to turn the age 21, they need to actually get the regular concealed weapons license, not just a concealed, not this provisional. So as time goes on and we have some 18, 19, and 20-year-olds get this license, if you are interacting with somebody who's 21 and they show you this as their concealed carry permit, it's actually not valid for somebody who's age 21 or older. Another thing to be aware of on this doesn't change the law in regards to possession of weapons at like high schools and stuff. You're not going to all of a sudden see a bunch of 18-year-old high school seniors packing concealed weapons and pistols down the hall as they're roaming the schools or high schools. That's still illegal. They can't do that, even if they have this permit. And it also doesn't change the age of who can purchase a firearm. Handguns, you have to be 21 years old to be able to purchase a handgun. And so even if you have this permit, you have the ability to carry concealed, but you still can't buy one. We'll see the impacts it has on this. We know we like our guns here in Utah, and this is a result of that. Whether it has negative consequences, I don't know. Time will tell. But be aware that this is just a provisional carry license. It doesn't change the normal concealed carry license.
House Bill 199 is not in your materials. It should have been on page 25. We just bring this to your attention. This was one that Sean Rays, the Attorney General, was very interested in. And what it basically is dealing with is, I don't like the term dispose, but disposing of, I'm not going to use that term. Let me back up. Parents who would like to adopt children sometimes will get children that have high needs, especially when they're adopting from out of country. They'll come over, they'll have fetal alcohol syndrome, they'll have drug addictions. I mean, we even face that here in the country. But what we have seen across the country is that parents who get these children and are unable to deal with the special needs of these babies are offloading them. Maybe, see, I still don't even like that term. But what, and this was a shock to me, I guess it shouldn't shock me, is that these parents and these people were actually selling these children on Craigslist. And we know who the type of people that are looking at Craigslist for children are. And so what this law says is it does provide provisions whereby parents who get themselves into this situation and realize that it's more than they can handle, and they would like to see, again, I still can't come up with a good term. I was going to say transfer ownership, but that's almost even worse. But where they would like to turn over custody of this child to a family member or to, you know, an authorized, licensed agency, things like that. There are provisions where they can do that. Whereas when parents resort to illegally transferring custody of their children in some of these other ways, then, of course, that makes it illegal. So just be aware of those changes in the statutes. Hopefully you'll never come across it. But after I heard about this bill, I actually went to Craigslist and on the internet and found ads where people are actually doing this. So it's pretty sad. House Bill 200, they're on page 25. You don't need to worry about the sexual assault kit processing amendments. It's the paragraph over at the top of page 26. I just want to bring your attention that by next summer, UPC and DPS will have created a training on trauma-informed response in sexual assault, sexual violence cases that you all will need to be trained on. So just be looking for that training. We'll either offer it, we can offer it online as well as hands-on, especially for those detectives and others that are charged with the actual investigation of that. So just be looking for that training that will be coming up. House Bill 206, it's misnumbered in the PDF. It says 201. They're on page 26, domestic violence weapons restrictions. It really should be House Bill 206. Apologize, we didn't catch that before we printed it. But what it has done is it has expanded the definition, the scope of Category 2 restricted persons on carrying weapons. So it includes individuals subject to a protective order or child protective order, as well as individuals who have been convicted of assault or aggravated assault against a cohabitant. This brings us in line with the federal law dealing with domestic violence, and so it will make it easier for our prosecutors to prosecute individuals when they are illegally in possession of weapons if they're these Category 2 restricted persons. The rest of the paragraph, the summary there, just talks about the requirements that we are going to have to show as a prosecutor when we're in court in order to prove that, so just be aware of that. But I think that's really all you need to know at this point.
House Bill 202, Trespass Amendments, begins on 26 and into 27. I call this the deadbeat brother-in-law law or the deadbeat couch surfer friend law, whatever we want to call it. But essentially, it's dealing with trespass on non-tenants. So just to frame our discussion here, this will not apply to any situation that there's a tenancy where there's a lease agreement or a rental agreement or somebody has established themselves as a tenant, they're paying rent, however those things are still going to have to be done through the civil process that they go through now. This essentially just says that a long-term guest, somebody who's been in the residence, whatever it may be, more than 48 hours, is guilty of Class B trespass if they remain after the owner or somebody who has the authority of the owner communicates that they need to leave. This bill, as I went around and I trained on this around the state, I had lots of questions on this, and people actually give me a lot of case scenarios. Well, what do you think about this? And what do you think about this? And the more I've thought about this law, the more I think that the messy cases that you were seeing before aren't going to be answered by this new law. I think that was the attempt, is some of these really messy cases where somebody just won't leave and police come out and they say, no, it's a civil issue. I don't think we're going to resolve a lot of those based upon this new law. But it does give law enforcement another opportunity, clarifies the trespass law. I think under the old trespass laws, they probably could have done everything that they could do under this new one. But it does clarify it a little bit and gives an officer the chance to forcefully remove somebody from the property if they're a long-term guest and they've been told to leave and they won't leave. One thing to be aware of is it does say that you need to give them a reasonable opportunity to collect their belongings. What reasonable means, that's up to you. You're the one who showed up. You're the one who's going to make that call. It's probably going to depend on how long they've been there, how much stuff they have. We certainly don't expect an officer to sit there for 5 hours while they collect their belongings, things like that. But they do need a reasonable opportunity to collect their personal belongings before they're forced out. Be aware that this law is now there for you to be able to use, but the really, really messy ones that you were seeing are probably still going to be really, really messy and you're probably going to still have some questions.
Yeah, well, I had a question on this. I won't say which jurisdiction it is, but apparently there was an officer that liked to host, you know, parties. And so he said, so does this mean after 48 hours, if they don't leave, then we can have them physically arrested and removed? I said, it sounds like it. I said, maybe what we want to do is when people show up on Friday for your party, you have to have them sign a waiver that you're giving them notice that they can only stay for 48 hours. After 48 hours, they're trespassing. So
interesting.
Yeah, anyway.
Sounds like a fun party.
Yeah. House Bill 208 on page 27. For those of you that work at the jail or are responsible for releasing people that have been arrested for jail, you'll remember, you'll know that there was a jail release agreement that used to only cover those who were convicted of domestic violence, whereas now that definition has been expanded. So you can give a no-contact order jail release for anybody that has its qualifying offense, which is domestic violence, offense against a child or a vulnerable adult, or any sexual assault, sex offense. So just realize that definition has been expanded.
I really like that.
Yeah, I think it's good.
Our most vulnerable victims are now being protected, not just domestic violence victims, who need to be, but others as well. So, House Bill 210, same page, flashing brake light revisions. This just makes a change to, the pulsating brake lights that you see that people can put on their vehicles. It used to be that if somebody applied the brakes and then let it off, there was like a lockout period that it couldn't pulsate again repeatedly. That lockout period's been taken off the books. So I'm not sure I've ever actually even seen these, but I have heard from a few officers that they have seen them. That lockout period's no longer a part of the law.
House Bill 217, bottom of page 27, is dealing with livestock harassment and motorized vehicles. So it's a Class B misdemeanor to use a motorized vehicle, a dog, a drone, to chase. Somebody put camels in here, but that's camels actually not in the statute. But, to chase any livestock with the intent of causing distress. This obviously does not apply to those folks in the rural jurisdiction that use their ATVs and other vehicles like that to herd cattle and whatnot. It's just if there is the intent of causing distress. For any subsequent offense or where the harassment seriously injures or kills livestock, or there is more than $1,000 in damages, then that is enhanced up to a Class A misdemeanor. Let's see.
House Bill 239.
Yeah. Oh, juvenile
page,
justice.
Page
yeah.
31. Juvenile justice amendments, and I'm not going to go into a great detail on this, because I'm being recorded, I'll probably be a lot less snarky than I was as I did this live when nobody was recording me.
That we know of.
that we know of. I was asked in one of the counties that I did this presentation before I started, which law is going to have the biggest effect? Which law that passed is going to change things the most for us? And this is absolutely the law that changes things the most in this legislative session. We all know that we went through JRI a couple years ago, that really had a major, major impact on a lot of things. Well, this is, and I think the bill sponsor and the legislature didn't want to view it this way, but sometimes you don't get to choose how people perceive what you do. And this is JRI for the juvenile justice system, and it probably is even bigger changes than JRI was for the adult system. There's many different implementation dates or effective dates throughout this bill. This is a huge bill. It was something like 6,000 or 8,000 lines, a couple hundred pages, whatever it was. I mean, this is a really, really big bill.
Yeah.
And so we can't, and I quite frankly and honestly don't know what all the changes are, but we can't spend all the time on it. But realize there's many different effective dates and implementation dates for some of these things. Some of the biggest changes you're going to see is if you're a school resource officer, how the law is enforced in schools. Be aware that anything that is for an infraction or a Class C misdemeanor or a status offense that happens in a school or on school property actually can't be referred to the juvenile court. And so a lot of times when some of these things were happening, they were getting referred to the juvenile court, truancy, smoking, disorderly conducts, things like that are Class Cs. You're not going to be able to refer those to the juvenile court anymore. For For Class B misdemeanors and all non-person Class A's, it's up to the school administrator if they're going to send it to the juvenile court or not. They have discretion. And so I always like, you know, it's an attorney's job to point out the extreme examples. And so I'll use an extreme example. Say that you have a run-of-the-mill Class B misdemeanor assault. Two students get into a fight at school and there's an assault. The losing party's parents are upset and want to press charges, and the school administrator decides no. As a police officer, there's nothing you're going to be able to do about that. It's going to be the school administrator's call whether that gets sent to the juvenile court or not. And again, I don't think that's going to happen, but under the law, it can happen. And so just be aware, there's all sorts of changes for non-judicial adjustments, prosecutors and their roles. Restitution is a huge change. If you're going to be a victim of a crime now, it's not going to pay to be a victim of a perpetrator who's a juvenile. Just realize that there are huge, huge changes in this. Who can go to detention? Who can go to secure care? How long they're in secure care? And it's just interesting. This came about the way it was explained to me. One of the reasons why this came about is some of the studies that CCJJ has done has shown that the youth that we are spending the most amount of resources on are the ones that recidivate the most. And so they're thinking that if we spend less resources on them, they won't recidivate as much. Well, the problem is those who are going to secure care and on youth parole and some of these things, these are the kids that the only reason why they're not in prison is because they're not old enough. These are the worst of the worst. And so that's why they're getting all of this attention. They don't become the worst of the worst because we've spent a lot of resources on them. And so there's just kind of maybe a differentiation in how people view those things. And so I probably won't say a whole lot more about this bill. It's huge. You need to work with your county attorneys if you have questions, because they're the ones that are going to have to be dealing with this in the juvenile court and the juvenile system. But there's huge changes here, so just be aware of that and work with your county attorneys on that bill.
I think, Tyson, you started to go down the road. It doesn't pay to be the victim of a juvenile. You're probably going to the restitution issues.
Yeah.
Is the restitution is no longer based on the the amount of restitution that is owed. You know, somebody keys your car, pops your tires, does whatever. It's restitution is now going to be determined based on the ability of the minor's family to pay. So I think that's where you're heading, is some of our victims may be out if, in fact.
Yeah. I actually worked in juvenile youth corrections before I went to law school, and I was in the secure care side. I had a kid in there who had done like almost $40,000 worth of damage of graffiti. And you think about that, if he was termed indigent by the court, he might not get any restitution ordered at all, maybe $100 on $40,000 worth of damage. Or if, say, he and a co-defendant who comes from a wealthy family go and do damage, you might see the wealthy juvenile's family get the full $40,000 restitution order, and the other juvenile who might have done even more of the damage get nothing. And so I understand the principle behind this, but how it's being carried out could be problematic for victims, certainly.
Yeah. House Bill 252 on page 35. This is disposal of firearms. This is one, it's a bill you need to look into. This is if you confiscate firearms as part of an investigation, there are now ways in which local departments can dispose of them by selling them through federally licensed firearms dealers, and the proceeds go to a couple of different pots of money. Of course, they need to be unclaimed, or that you can't turn over for whatever reason. It also says that you can destroy them if they're unfit for sale, associated with a notorious crime. But just be aware that in certain circumstances, firearms that you seize, you might be able to sell them and earn a little bit of money from that.
274.
Mm-hmm.
Human trafficking modifications on page 36. This is another bill that was our attorney general was very involved in. It clarified what force, fraud, or coercion means. So there's some clarification language in that. Another thing that it does, and it may have a bigger impact on law enforcement directly, is it provides a vacature for victims of human trafficking who maybe had been convicted of crimes in the past. So say you have somebody who has prostitution conviction or solicitation, or say they have drug convictions, different things like that. And then later they're able to come back and show and actually provide evidence and prove that they were doing that prostitution, or they were selling drugs or doing drugs or whatever as part of being a victim of human trafficking. This is not an expungement of their record. It's actually a vacature. The court can take action and vacate that conviction and completely wipe it off of their record. This is a good thing, and I think one of the challenges we're going to have is law enforcement officers might be called in to testify about those initial crimes at a vacature hearing. But the problem is you probably weren't going to go forward with that charge if you knew that the person was being trafficked at the time anyway. So what evidence is going to be able to be shown, I don't know, and how that's going to impact you as law enforcement, I don't know. But they are going to have to prove that their action was done in the process of human trafficking to qualify for this new vacature provision.
Let's see. House Bill 354 over the bottom of page 40, dealing with digital piracy. This bill just brings us into the digital age. It used to be that if you had a pirated DVD or a pirated CD, you just had one DVD. You had one CD, and that would count as a single count, whereas now we know that this pirated media can be loaded on a thumb drive. You can have thousands and thousands of songs and hundreds of videos and whatnot. And so this statute now just breaks it down. I think it's for every 10 files, it equals one count, or you'll want to look at the statute for the exact number. So if you've just got a single thumb drive that's got, you know, 1,000 songs on it, then you may have, if I do my math correct, 100 counts of digital piracy for the song. So just be aware of that when you're investigating that. Yeah, I don't do math very well. And Chris won't let me turn my phone on, so I can't use a calculator. Okay, over on page 41, House Bill 369, criminal penalty enhancements for sexual assault offenses. What this is dealing with is it's an enhancement to the sexual assault if the perpetrator knew that he or she wasn't.
Something just happened.
Anyway, so it enhances any sexual offense that's not already a first degree felony is bumped up one level. So, you know, B to an A, C, dealing with misdemeanors, third to a second to first. And, you know, of course, not first isn't going to go up to capital offense. But as I said, if the perpetrator knew that he or she was infected with HIV, Hep B, or Hep C. Now, the thing is all they have to do is know. It doesn't matter if they are in remission, if they're not showing any signs, symptoms of you know, being infected. And it doesn't matter that the offense they commit, that they could actually transmit the disease. So if you, for example, if, you know, grabbing somebody's butt underneath their clothing, you know, is a sexual assault, but you don't transfer HIV, Hep B, Hep C, you know, simply through a touch, but that doesn't matter. What it comes down to is whether or not they knew. So just be aware of those enhancements and changes.
House Bill 379, Classification of Theft Amendments, on page 42. This is another one that's going to have a large impact, actually, across the board. As it was explained to me by Paul Boyden, the theft enhancement was actually the first enhancement that we ever had on Utah statute.
Oh,
so the first thing that we could ever actually enhance was theft. And I think our legislature has gotten tired of that theft enhancement, and so they are whittling it down. Instead of getting rid of it, they've created a definition for the enhancement that makes it very, very difficult to get the enhancement. And that's what we will see in this. Before I get to the theft enhancement, there's actually a clarification in the law in regards to the second-degree felony of committing theft when you're possessing a firearm. It used to just be that if you committed any theft and had possession of a firearm, you were guilty, could be guilty of a second-degree felony. With that. So if you had somebody who was a concealed weapons license holder who went in and stole a candy bar, technically under the law, they could have been charged with a second-degree felony, even if they never even showed the gun, threatened to use the gun, nobody knew they had a gun, just the possession of that gun made that a secondary felony. Now, we didn't see that very often, but that did come up last year, and so that's why this got changed. You basically have to either threaten the use of the gun, show the gun, display the gun for it to be the second-degree felony. Now on to the enhancements. It has always been that if you commit two thefts, the third within a 10-year period is going to be a felony, regardless of value, regardless of what your priors were. That has now changed. So to be able to get to that enhancement to a third-degree felony when it comes to just simply priors, obviously the value enhancement's still there. But if we're going off of priors, this is what you have to do. You still have to have the two priors. One of those priors needs to have been a Class A misdemeanor. And the current offense has to have a value of more than $500. So what you're going to see is that $500 triggers us to a Class A misdemeanor. So essentially, you will not be able to enhance a Class B misdemeanor theft to a third-degree felony anymore under the statute. And so if you're dealing with a Class A that has a value over $500 and one of the two priors was a Class A misdemeanor, you can now enhance to the felony. Like I said, it's going to make it extremely difficult to enhance cases to the felony, your run-of-the-mill thefts anymore. And I think that was the legislative intent, is to make it very difficult to actually get that enhancement anymore. You know, this is a response to what we're seeing, especially in Salt Lake County, where we have the homeless population, where people are getting, you know, 25, 30, 40, 50 theft charges, and parole just doesn't want to deal with them. They don't want them to go to – we don't want them in prison. It's not the right place for them, and I think we all agree with that. But we don't want them on parole either, taking up resources and things. And so we're trying to make the petty thefts not get there and just the more beefier ones. And that's a Salt Lake County problem and not really a problem anywhere else in the state, as far as it's been reported to me. But that's where really the change on this comes from, is trying to whittle down those petty thefts and the resources that they take to supervise them and things like that.
Okay, jumping over to page 47, House Bill 433. This is a penalty for targeting law enforcement officers, and this was intended to be a good idea. Representative Paul Ray is a friend to law enforcement. It just, the way that we got this bill, or the way that this bill was passed, is a little bit clunky, and frankly, I don't think you'll be able to enforce it. It enacts a new section, 765-210, targeting law enforcement officer. And so it gives us a definition of what a law enforcement officer is, but what the statute is and what we have to prove. But the problem is one of the elements that we have to prove is that the violence, the unlawful force or violence that was against a police officer is in furtherance of a political or social objective done in order to intimidate or coerce a civilian population or to influence or affect the conduct of a government or a unit of government. As I said, you know, the start out is a good idea. We hate to see the cases where officers are shot in their car, were murdered in their cars, or sitting on the side of the road writing a report. But how many of those really are those murders take place in order to further a political or social objective, or to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, or to affect the conduct of a government, you know, local government, state government, whatever? Most of the time it's not. It's just these guys that have a thing and they want to kill a cop. So this, I mean, it started out as a good idea, but I imagine that we're going to see some changes in it in the next session. In fact, over on top of page 48, there's a comment there that there's a replacement bill that's being considered. And so we'll see if that happens, where it just simply makes it a first-degree felony to commit an assault on an officer that results in serious bodily injury or death. I did skip over, Tyson. I think you're looking. I'll go back. House Bill 381, only those of you guys that are dealing with dealing with grammar requests in relation to body cameras, just take a look at that. But most of you, that's not going to apply to.
Yeah, for sure. That wraps up our House bills. We're on to the Senate bills now. Senate Bill 31 on page 53, Protection of Law Enforcement Officers' Personal Information. This is a bill that is intended to prevent groups or individuals from posting the personal information, identification, address, phone numbers, whatever it might be, of law enforcement officers or the immediate family of law enforcement officers. Under this new law, just simply posting, knowing somebody's a law enforcement officer, and posting personal information, identifying information about them or their immediate family on the internet or social media is now a Class B misdemeanor. This is intended. We had a big, obviously very public and nationally publicized case with the dog that was shot in Salt Lake City when they were searching for the young girl. And that officer's information was posted by animal rights groups all over and caused some real problems. And we've had other situations around the state that aren't as nationally publicized as that, but maybe as locally publicized where this type of thing happens. And so this bill is intended to stop and prevent that from happening, which is a good thing. One of the unintended consequences, I think, with this bill is it doesn't make an exception for the law enforcement officer or their family. And so if you are active on social media and you're posting pictures of yourself or your children, you could technically be a technical violation of this law. I jokingly at one of the trainings said, so if you have a spouse or significant other who's a little too active on social media, just threaten them that you're going to call the police on them and have them turned in for doing that. And I thought everybody received that as a joke, but I got a call from an officer the next day saying that he went home and told his wife that, and it didn't go over very well. So let me make sure that you guys realize that I'm joking in regards to that. I don't recommend that you make that threat to your spouse or significant other in regards to that. But again, just one of maybe the unintended consequences behind this is that and while I don't think your county and city attorneys are going to charge you as officers for doing that, there is not an exception in the new language, allowing you and your family to post your own personal information. So you could technically be in violation of these things. So just be aware of that.
And actually, again, down south, I won't say where, one of the officers, he and his wife run a bed and breakfast out of their house. And so, of course, they're advertising on social media and the internet. And so when they post a picture of their home with the address of where to come, again, it's, you're violating the statute. So my guess is we're going to see some exceptions, amendments to that statute this next session.
Yeah. I'm going to skip over to Senate Bill 50 on page 55, Automobile Insurance Registry Amendments. There is just a brief change here, or a small change that actually makes a big impact for how officers deal with no insurance on the side of the road. It used to be that if you pulled somebody over and they didn't have insurance, there was a shall impound the vehicle as part of that when it came to this. This amends the shall. If somebody does not have insurance and they're involved in an accident is when you now have the shall, that you shall impound the vehicle. Realize that it doesn't prevent you from doing an impound. If you feel like the impound is appropriate, you still may impound the vehicle under this new code. It just simply changes what the shall is.
There's a couple asset forfeiture ones that Ty and I aren't going to get into a lot of detail. They're AG bills. The first one is Senate Bill 70 at the bottom of page 56, and then over Senate Bill 87 over on page 59. In essence, if you guys are doing asset forfeiture as part of your investigations, you're going to want to get with your county or city attorneys because the legislature is making it increasingly difficult to go through this process. So in essence, it's basically cutting us off at the knees, and you're probably not going to want to do it, but talk with your county or city attorneys about it.
Page 60, Senate Bill 90, Vehicle Inspection Registration Amendments. I've termed this the Fix-It Ticket Bill. Let's start with expired registration, then we'll get into equipment violations. So if somebody has an expired registration and they're within 60 days of that expiration, so that kind of formulates where we're at for this discussion. They're expired and they're within 60 days. If you write them a ticket for expired registration and then they go in within 14 days, get their vehicle registered, they will not be subject to fines or fees in the court. So essentially it becomes a fix-it ticket even if you don't write it as a fix-it ticket. All equipment violations are now fix-it tickets under the statute. You write an equipment violation, they have 14 days to go get it fixed, and if they do and they provide proof to the court, they will not be subject to fines or fees. as part of that ticket. And so just realize that, and I think many officers are writing those as fix-it tickets anyways, but even if they're not written as a fix-it ticket, it is a fix-it ticket now going forward. So just be aware on that. There's actually a miss, it was mistitled, or the code it amended in here is not for expired registration, but that was the intent, and so we may need to actually clean that up in the next legislative session. The code it amended is not dealing with expired registration, but all the language is dealing with expired registration. So just realize that's probably how it's going to be enforced in the courts as well. Page 61, Senate Bill 96, unsecured load amendments. This just goes to address the penalties in regards to people with unsecured loads. And they're just enhancing the penalty based upon the damage that's caused by your unsecured load. To cite somebody with this unsecured load, you're always going to have an unsecured load that creates a hazard, okay? And so you're probably talking about an unsecured load where something's fallen off, a couch, a dresser, whatever it might be, a shelf, a piece of metal, whatever, has fallen off and it's in the road and it creates a hazard. If no accident is caused because of that, but it just creates the hazard, it's an infraction. If it creates a hazard and it leads to an accident, it's a Class B misdemeanor. And if the hazard leads to an accident that results in serious bodily injury or death, it's a Class A misdemeanor. We all remember that super, super sad case of, I believe it was up in Box Elder County within the last couple years, where the mattress fell off a truck or a trailer and somebody was riding a motorcycle at night and hit it and died. And that's really what this is trying to address, is those types of situations. And that was a pure accident. Nobody did this intentionally, but because of recklessness and not securing that load, somebody lost their life. And so the more damage your unsecured load does, the higher penalty you're going to have in regards to that.
Yeah, I looked that one up too. And to the driver's credit, you know, he didn't know that he'd lost the mattress, and it wasn't until it was reported in the news and he turned himself in. So,
yep, exactly. Yeah. Total accident, but could have been prevented.
Yep. House Bill 63, Senate Bill 111, again, apologize, another typo. This should be titled Unmanned Aircraft Amendments, as opposed to Manned Aircraft. So this is dealing with drones. So first of all, it creates a Class B misdemeanor if a person flies an unmanned aircraft that carries a weapon, unless the person is authorized by the FAA, obtains a contract with a federal or state government to operate that. I think, Tyson, you were so sad.
I want
that,
one of these licenses.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to be able to hook an AR-15 to a drone and go take care of our coyote problem up here in Harriman that we see on the news every once in a while.
Yeah, exactly. So the middle paragraph there, it's talking about for people that operate an unmanned aircraft for recreational purposes, but they fail to operate under all of the statutory requirements and restrictions that are out there. When you come across them, encounter them the first time, is you give them a warning. The next time that you or another officer encounters them unlawfully operating their for recreational purposes, then it becomes an infraction. For the third or subsequent violations, it becomes a Class B misdemeanor, but only if the person has been successfully convicted earlier of an infraction or a misdemeanor. So what this is going to require is that you guys somehow make some kind of a notation, whether it's going to show up, you know, when you pull up their driver's license, or, you know, some other record that they in fact have been warned, but you guys need to start keeping track of that, when you have warned somebody for illegally operating their recreational drone. It also expands the definition of trespass when you are using a drone. So if you remain on or over property, you intend to annoy, injure, damage property, or you're reckless, you're intending to commit a crime, then it becomes an enhanceable offense. So you'll want to take a look at that. Simply flying your drone over somebody else's property, you know, you're trying to get a picture of the lake or a stream or whatever, just simply passing over is not enough for the trespass. It has to be that criminal intent. So take a look at the language there.
Senate Bill 118 on page 64, criminal law amendments. This actually covers a wide variety of different things. So take a look at this. I won't spend a ton of time on a lot of it. But computer crimes, hacking, there's some clarification in there as well in regards to value and whatnot. making a false alarm or false reports, emergency reporting. There's some enhancements that are added to and clarified in there as well. One change I am going to point out, because I think it applies to more of you who would be listening to this, is the electronic communication harassment language, the intent language has changed slightly. It used to include annoy, alarm, offend, intimidate, abuse, threaten, harass, frighten, or disrupt the electronic communications of others. The annoy, alarm, or offend portions of that intent language have been removed. And so if you'd been doing electronic communication cases based upon them intentionally annoying, alarming, or offending another party by disrupting their electronic communication, usually text messages, right? You're going to need to go under that intimidate, abuse, threaten, harass, frighten, or disrupt. So that's probably the biggest change in here that will apply to most of you. These others are more specialized targets in regards to like hacking and some of the others.
Also swatting, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Swatting, yeah. As well as included in that. So take a look at that, because that is something that was addressed in that bill.
Yeah. Over top of page 72, Senate Bill 159, all this does is changes the age where people riding a motorcycle have to wear helmets. So you now have to be 21 or older to not have to have a helmet. And so this is anybody on a highway, including dirt roads that are out there. And a motorcycle includes a definition of a motor-driven cycle, a Class 3 electric-assisted bicycle, and an auto cycle not fully enclosed, quote-unquote. I understand those are the slingshots and the razors, so just be aware that it's been bumped up to 21 and under have to have a helmet.
It's interesting on that. This is another soapbox issue for me, so I'll jump on that for 1 second. I was driving down the road with my 4-year-old not too long ago, and just out of the blue, she said, "Daddy, that guy over there is not being very safe." And I didn't know what she was talking about, and I said, "What do you mean?" And she pointed out the motorcycle rider who was over in the HOV lane that didn't have a helmet on. Mm. She said, "He's not wearing a helmet." And I just think, you know, if my 4-year-old gets it, we should all be able to get it, right?
Yeah.
But again, once you turn 21, now the law allows you to decide how much protection you want between your skull and the pavement.
Right, right.
So,
yeah, because you're so smart at 21.
Yes. Senate Bill 230, page 77. This is some changes to the solicitation, essentially sexual solicitation. It clarifies, and part of this is in response to, you know, some of our vice stings, some of the solicitation stings, it changes how far into the act and the procedure that we basically have to get before there's evidence to go forward with this bill. It's a good change for those officers who are involved in these things. They don't have to be in quite such a difficult situation in regards to these stings. It also provides that max fines for Johns. So if we do have somebody who's convicted of these things, who's a John, who's soliciting these things, the court does not have discretion to lower their fines. They have to impose the maximum fine for Johns on these cases now.
Yeah, so the I used to prosecute Norm, and we started to prosecute some of these, and we received some training from one of the larger jurisdictions in the state, which shall remain unnamed, but their policy used to be that officers could get naked. They just couldn't, and they couldn't touch for more than 3 seconds or something like that. So, yeah, you don't have to do that anymore. We did not adopt that policy anymore. Let's see.
There's a reason why most vice squads have gone away, right?
Yeah. Let's see. 232?
232, yep.
Okay, cyber exploitation amendments. This is on page 78. This is you know, soapbox one as well, is it basically is coming down and saying that if you're under the age of 18 and you are sexting your boyfriend, girlfriend, that that's not an offense. It's only an offense if you're over the age of 18. But who is it that's sending these kinds of pictures out? I mean, here's my soapbox. Fortunately, my kids didn't have cell phones, you know, when they were that age. Maybe I'm aging myself, but you know,
I didn't have a cell phone when I was that age either.
Yeah. But you know, but really, who is it that's sending out these compromising images? It's kids under the age of 18, And so, you know, this bill, and here jump in, Tyson, you know, as you see fit. But there's really nothing in place right now that that prohibits teenagers from doing that. And so I think
And it even goes a little bit further, Bob, because it's the sextortion. It's not just the sexting. It's somebody who maybe has a compromising video or picture of somebody else. And they say, if you don't come over and have sex with me, I'm going to send this to your bishop or to your parents or to put it on Facebook or whatever. And it now creates real serious penalties for those things, which I think everybody would agree is a good thing. But the legislature specifically says that it only applies to people over the age of 18. And I have the same concerns as you do, where I sit here and I think it's appalling to me that we feel like, what are we saying? That sextortion is just boys will be boys when it's teenagers? Yeah. And we're not going to make this against the law. It's perfectly healthy and reasonable behavior for a 16-year-old to have a compromising picture of maybe his ex-girlfriend and say, if you don't come over and perform oral sex on me, I'm going to send this to your parents or whatever. That's totally okay for a 16-year-old, but once you turn 18, it's not healthy behavior anymore.
Yeah.
That's the burr in my saddle with this is, and they didn't want to strap, and the justification was they didn't want to strap minors with these serious charges. Well, these are serious crimes, and so it's one of those things where you can, you know, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen type thing. If you commit the crime, you need to do the time, and it's really concerning for me. Sorry, this is probably the bill that bothers me the most in all of this.
No, I agree.
But that we just are completely giving our teenagers a pass on this. Is really, really concerning to me.
Yeah, again, the ICAC prosecutor that I was talking to said that this one in particular, we're baby powdering our teenagers, you know, and not holding them accountable for what they're doing.
Yeah.
Let's see. Senate Bill 235, the bottom of page 78, Assault and Threat of Violence Amendment. As you'll recall, back in 2015, we cleaned up, again, our assault statute. And this, you know, for a lot of different reasons, possession of a weapon, things like that, but we took out threat accompanied by an immediate show of force or violence. That was no longer an element of the assault statute. That had it went into its own statute. Well, we realized that there were a couple other bills that we needed to fix that. So the language, so the following sections were affected: assault against a school employee, assault against a peace officer, a military service member in uniform, and assault against a healthcare provider or emergency medical service worker. That language, threat accompanied by an immediate show of force or violence, has been taken out of those three sections and has just been added to the threat statute itself. So just some minor changes there in how you charge that.
Senate Bill 239, page 79. This is actually our last one that we have. Interfering with a peace officer. One thing that to be aware of with this is it doesn't really change any definitions, but it does clarify that simply recording a peace officer doing their duty is not enough to be considered interfering. And I think most peace officers would say, well, yeah, of course it doesn't, but it wouldn't be here if hadn't had problems with that. So just being annoying and being a jerk is not illegal, unfortunately. And you still have every bit of right as a police officer and a law enforcement officer to secure a scene, to make sure that the area is safe. And if people are intruding and impairing your ability to do that, then you still have the right to protect yourself and to enforce the law. But simply somebody sitting on the other side of the road filming you do this is not going to count for interfering. I share an example of a case that I handled on conflict. And again, the jurisdiction will remain nameless. And it was a conflict case that I had taken because of the facts of the case. But it was essentially a person who police had responded to a call on a DV case, and they saw their local troublemaker across the street filming them as they came up. And instead of responding to the DV investigation, they went over and spent 10 minutes arguing with this guy about him not being able to film from the other side of the road, and that he had crossed the road, he jaywalked, and all these things. And I'm sitting here thinking, guys, you got called out to a DV call. What's going on here? And that became problematic.
Well, I like what you said. Maybe you're going to mention it is on the recording. your officer saying, if I weren't having to deal with you, I could be over responding to the DV?
Yeah, you're interfering with my investigation. I'm here talking to you, and I'm just sitting here thinking we'll just go handle your DV case.
Exactly.
So if those officers are listening to this, well, I already told you that you messed up, so you already know that. but just realize that as annoying as it is, and as we understand, you guys have a hard job, and sometimes emotions are running high, and things that end up on video don't tell the whole story, and they may be portray you in a negative light unfairly, and that's unfortunate. But we need to understand that this alone is not going to be interfering. We had the question come up with, like, SWAT. If you have a SWAT situation, what do you do? People are broadcasting Facebook Live, and then all of a sudden they're giving up tactical things. And you do have the ability, like I said, to secure a scene. But if somebody's Facebook Living from their bedroom window, you're going to have a hard time getting in that home and getting that recording turned off, and especially saying that they were interfering. And so if you have enough evidence and enough justification to do so, then do it. But make sure, one of the things we've been telling officers is, you're being recorded, so just justify verbally why you're making the requests or demands that you're making. Because not only will they be on your video if you have a body cam, but you'll be on their video that will end up on YouTube. The interesting question comes up with the bill that we talked about of publicizing officers' personal identifying information on the internet. If somebody's videoing you and you're identified on the video and they post it, are they violating that law? Potentially, they could be. Another question that came up is, what do you do if you believe that somebody has recorded and has actual evidence of the crime? We're not advising that you go and take their phone from them and seize their phone, because you're going to have to get a warrant to get into that phone anyways. You can detain them and get a warrant and instruct them that they're not to delete anything off the phone. They're not to delete or alter that evidence in any way. And just get your warrant, and then you're completely covered if that happens. So that kind of wraps up anything that we have here. I'll just make my closing spiel and then turn the time over to Bob if he wants to say anything. Again, if you have questions on these things, please feel free to reach out to us. We're not the experts in every one of these, but we're happy to help, and we'll direct you to people who will be able to answer your questions. But we're here. We're on your side. We're willing to be a resource in any way that we can. So just let us know if you have questions, and we'll help out any way we can.
Yeah, and if you didn't catch it up front, Tyson is our traffic safety resource prosecutor, and he's the expert, and he has got a lot of trainings that he would love to come and give to your jurisdictions. He's on grant funds, and so he can come and train you for free. And he does a great job. So I just encourage you to invite him out as much and as often as you can. We appreciate Chris helping us out here. We appreciate Post doing the recording. I think we're not going to give up our day jobs.
No.
But we appreciate you guys listening to us, and we will see you next year.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Director Bob Church and Tyson Skeen with the Utah Prosecution Council, for this presentation. On behalf of the Utah Prosecution Council, Statewide Association of Prosecutors, and Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training, thank you for listening in today. If you'd like more information on previous and upcoming training events, we invite you to log in to the ACADIS training portal and search under the registration tab.